Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Araqi Voices. This is your host, Hassan Haddad. Araqi Voices is a podcast that showcases authentic perspectives and insights about current developments in Iraq. Araqi Voices is produced by 1001 Araqi Thoughts. Last week, Iraqis voted in the country's national parliamentary election. The Independent High Electoral Commission, or IHEC, has published the final election results. This episode, I want to focus on those results and analyze the trends we find in them. To do so, I'm joined once again by Ali Al-Mawlawi. Ali, let's start by asking you if any new data has come out since last week when everybody was focused on the 56.11% participation rate during those elections.
So all the data has now been tallied up. We now have 100% of the votes counted. And what we know is that indeed the turnout rate was just over 56%, about 12 million people voted altogether. What is interesting in terms of new data is what proportion of those votes were deemed void ballots. So it's actually still quite high. Just for context, the 2021 elections, we had a rate of 7.5% of ballots that were void. This time around, the rate is around 6%. It's still a very high rate. We're talking about more than 700,000 votes that were void. We don't know the reason for that. This is something that I often wonder about because we don't really have a culture of spoiling ballots as a protest vote. So the only other explanation is that it's a technical issue. Now, that may be that voters simply aren't aware of how to cast their ballots correctly, or it could be another technical issue going on.
700,000 votes is a lot of votes. I understand as a percentage that's gone down, but given that more people voted in the 2025 elections versus the 2021 elections, that's a large number of void ballots. And for IHEC to not give us a reason why those ballots are void does give a little bit of concern here.
It is very high. I would say that the highest rates were found in Sulaymaniyah and Erbil, much higher than the rest of Iraq. So in total, in those two provinces, about 250,000 ballots were deemed void. In Sulaymaniyah, 18% of all ballots cast were void. In Erbil, that was a bit less, around 14.5%. So if you exclude those two provinces, you still get a rate of around 4%. Which is, I think, still much higher than it should be. I mean, just for reference, if you look at the rates in elections in the US or the UK, for instance, that rate is usually just a fraction of 1%. This is something I really do think that IHEC needs to get on top of, because we're talking about hundreds of thousands of votes that, for some reason or other, are not being cast properly. Now, if they are protest votes, then that shouldn't be difficult to ascertain just by looking at these ballots. You can usually tell whether it's a deliberate spoiling of the vote or not. But I do think that, as I said, this is something that IHEC needs to look into. Maybe it is just the fact that voters, many of them, are unaware of the correct way of casting a ballot. And if that is the case, then that is a shortcoming by IHEC in terms of educating voters about how to correctly cast a ballot.
I want to ask if these spoiled ballots come from the special early vote for the security forces that took place on the 9th of November, or if they come from the regular election day for civilians on the 11th of November?
We don't actually know. The data that's been released by IHEC doesn't break it down in that way. And on a broader point, you know, there's still a lot of data that we don't have that would ideally be available to help us understand the trends in these elections. So for instance, we don't have any exit polling, so we don't know why people voted the way that they did. We also don't know how many new time voters participated this time around. We do know that compared to 2021, there was an increase of about 2.5 million votes. Now, whether these are people that are first-time voters or those that decided not to vote for some reason 4 years ago and have come back to vote again, we just don't know. And without that sort of data, we really are just bordering on speculation.
One thing I don't want to speculate on are the Tishreen parties and the fact that nobody's talking about the Tishreen parties and how well they did or maybe how well they didn't do. So can you run us through some of the numbers that you crunched on the Tishrin parties, please?
Yeah, so essentially there were three main electoral lists that ran that were aligned with the Tishrin movement. You had the Bedir Alliance and then the Civil Democratic Alliance and also the Fao Zaho grouping. And of those three, only one of them secured a seat in parliament. That was the Fao Zaho Alliance, and that was the head of that party, Amr Abdel Jabbar. So it really was a huge setback for those parties. But yeah, there's a lot of interesting data about why they did so poorly. I think the sort of the conventional view is that it was the electoral law that undermined their chances. And while there is certainly some truth to that, the fact that the system reverted back to proportional representation with larger voting districts, it's true that these new emerging parties were able to compete much better under the 2021 system, where the voting districts were smaller and it was a single non-transferable vote system. But I do think that this explanation doesn't tell the full picture. And it's only when you really crunch the numbers and take a very granular look at what happened to the voter base, do you realize that actually for all of these parties, their voter base essentially collapsed. And that doesn't have a lot to do with the system. It's actually something else that we need to really dig into.
And can you give us an example of this? Because I know you crunched the numbers. So I'm sure there are instances of an individual running in 2021, also running in 2025. Is there a difference in the total number of votes that they received?
Yeah, that's really the stark difference. So if you look at, for instance, the Imtidad MPs, you know, Imtidad was the primary Tishrin-aligned movement that won 9 seats in 2021. That went up to 15 seats after the Sadrists withdrew from parliament. Now, of those 15 MPs, 11 of them decided to run this time around. Now, you can compare how many votes those 11 MPs won 4 years ago with how many they won this time around. And this is where the voter collapse is so stark, because in 2021, these 11 MPs won a total of 170,000 votes. This time around, those same MPs only secured 25,000 or just over 25,000 votes. So we're talking about only 15% of voters who voted for these MPs turned up this time and voted for them. So that's a really very clear example of a collapse in the voter base that has very little to do with the actual system, because the electoral system only really determines how seats are shared amongst competing parties. It doesn't really limit candidates from securing the maximum amount of votes that they can. So that was really the biggest example of how poorly the Tishrin-aligned parties did.
So I'd imagine there's some disillusionment with the voter base for these Tishrin MPs that their constituents did not come out and vote for them again. So I'd imagine they see these people as either not delivering on their behalf or potentially selling out during those 4 years, as we saw larger parties scoop up some of these independents and they weren't really independent anymore. And in terms of not performing for them, there is a clear 4-year time period during which they can assess their MP and see during those 4 years, what did they really do when they were in parliament? How well were they able to hold government accountable? And what sort of laws they were able to pass?
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. You know, we spoke last week about Ishraqat Kanun. Ishraqat Kanun is also a newly emerging party that was set up back in 2021. Now, it wasn't overtly aligned to the Tishrin movement, but it was a party that was set up with organic grassroots support, primarily in sort of the Mid-Euphrates region. And they have managed to consolidate their gains despite the change in the electoral system. And we mentioned this last week, their overall voter base doubled. It went from 100,000 votes in total to 200,000. And if you look at their MPs, most of whom ran again, they either were able to maintain more or less their own individual voter base, or they even increased their number of votes. So again, there's something that we need to really look into a little bit more deeply about the performance of specifically Imtidad as a party and also as individual MPs. But also, I think beyond that, you know, if you look at Badil, the candidates that they fielded, and if you look at the Civil Democratic Alliance, in addition to the Fawzakho Alliance, when you look at how many votes their candidates were winning in the provinces that they ran, the vast majority of these candidates were only securing double or triple digit votes. So we're talking about many, many candidates who were only able to secure a few hundred votes, some of them even less than that. So that is also a kind of a strategic error in the sense that they're fielding candidates that have no sort of popular recognition. And this is a real problem because it's not just about fielding candidates that you think have integrity or could do a good job as MPs. You need to field candidates that are known amongst the society that they are running in. And so there's very little point in investing in a candidate, spending money and time on a candidate that only has the ability to win a few hundred votes.
A moment ago, you mentioned one of the Tishreen MPs who ran again and won, Amr. Out of curiosity, what province did he run in?
Yeah, so that's Amr Abdel Jabbar, who was a former minister of transportation many, many years ago. And his party, the Fawzakho Alliance, he ran in Basra. And in fact, he did really well this time around. He managed to win in 2021 around 8,000 votes. And this time around, he got more than 29,000 votes. However, I think his approach was very different to the other candidates in the sense that he's a very vocal public figure. And one of the issues that he spent a lot of time talking about is the Khor Abdullah debacle with Kuwait, that for many Basrawis is a hugely sensitive issue that they're very much concerned about. And because he has spent a lot of time talking about that in particular, he's managed to gain a lot of popularity in Basra. And that's really the primary reason why he was able to retain his seat in parliament.
So interesting that Basra is keeping the Tishreen movement alive in the Iraqi parliament. And also interesting that this one MP basically ran on the issue of Khor Abdullah, not to do with sectarian politics, not to do with, you know, education or healthcare or anything like that, but an international issue. I find that interesting.
Yeah, I think because the issue of Khor Abdullah directly affects the people of Basra, that's why it's resonated amongst his constituents. But I do think that there is a broader challenge for the Tishreen movement or those parties that align with that sort of brand of politics, which is that the challenge of remaining relevant and the fact that the messages that resonated 4 years ago seemingly don't resonate anymore. And so there is that challenge, I believe, from those parties that are still emerging, that are seeking to build their grassroots organic support, that they need to reconfigure their messaging, their approach to politics. And I would say that, you know, looking at Ishraq al-Qanun is an interesting way of trying to understand what works and what doesn't, because their primary platform, from what I've seen, is they've run on the message of integrity, that their MPs hold a lot of integrity amongst their supporters. And they've actually been very shy of the limelight. They haven't been very prominent MPs in terms of appearing on these debate talk shows, but they've very much invested a lot of their time engaging with their constituents over the past 4 years. And that appears to have paid dividends for them.
Speaking of what works and what doesn't, we saw this week the coordination framework meet at former Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi's house for the first post-election meeting. Can you talk to us about what that meeting was like, what were the outcomes, and what we can expect?
So as expected, the framework announced that they would be the largest parliamentary bloc, meaning that the nominee for the Prime Minister would come from them. Interestingly, Prime Minister Sudani attended that meeting, indicating that he wants to remain part of the framework. That also, I think, is a sign that he understands that the only chance he has of being able to secure the premiership for a second term is through the framework, rather than trying to circumvent them.
Speaking of chances, the number one topic in Baghdad is the chances of a second term for Prime Minister Soudani. Talk me through your thinking about his chances.
I think you have to look at how the decision for choosing the next prime minister is going to come about. And the framework has made it very clear that the way they will decide is through a collective decision, meaning that everyone needs to be on board, or at the very least, the factions that aren't convinced about a particular nominee do not actively oppose that nomination. And on that basis, I think it's very clear that there are enough factions within the coordination framework that oppose a second term for Prime Minister Soudani, meaning that I think he has a very, very slim chance of securing a second term.
Another candidate that everybody's talking about is former Prime Minister Nour el-Maliki. He ran as the head of his coalition, State of Law, here in Baghdad. And his spokespeople during the election campaign said bluntly that we are seeking the premiership. How serious was that claim?
I think the only former prime minister that has any chance of making a comeback is Haider al-Abadi. I don't think any of the other previous prime ministers really stand a chance, because they would need the support of the entire coordination framework. And that just doesn't exist for any of the other candidates. I think with Abadi, the difference is that, number one, he doesn't have his own bloc anymore in parliament. And so he may be considered a compromise candidate, particularly given that he has a decent track record during his time as prime minister. He didn't overstep the bounds as other prime ministers have done. And so I do think of those former prime ministers as candidates, he's the only one that will be in the running, in addition to all of the other names that are being floated around.
My understanding is that's the reason why he didn't even run in these elections, so that he can be seen as the compromise candidate and that he can be seen as someone who isn't a threat to his political competition. And for that reason, this is by design. It's not by accident that his name is being floated. And as you said, he is the only current or former prime minister who stands a chance at becoming the next prime minister of Iraq.
Yeah, and I think also the coordination framework over the past 5 years has taken stock of the lessons of the past. You know, if you look at the experience they had, the Shia parties, with the nomination of Adil Abdel Mehdi, there were a lot of lessons learned from that. And we've talked about this in the past. I think that that approach to nominating Abdel Mehdi backfired significantly for the parties that brought him to power. And those were primarily the ones that were closely aligned with Iran. And so those parties have now learned that lesson, not to overstep the mark, not to try to cannibalize the entire government to their advantage. And then on the other spectrum, you have someone like Soudani, who was nominated on the basis of having a lot of experience working within government. He had good relations with all of the parties. And yet the coordination framework's perception of him largely is that he overstepped many red lines in his approach to governing, in particular his sort of use of state resources to advance his political and his electoral chances. And so I think what they're looking for is someone who will work within the existing elite pact, who will not overstep the mark, and who does not have necessarily long-term ambitions to consolidate power.
One question I have for you are the photos we saw of different Shia political leaders, such as Nour el-Maliki, Ammar al-Hakim, Qais al-Khazali, Hadi al-Amri, going to see Faleh al-Fayyad. And of course, he was a big part of the Reconstruction and Development Coalition, RDC, of Prime Minister Soudani. Are they trying to cozy up to Faleh al-Fayyad to break up RDC?
I think the future of Sudani's coalition largely depends on how these negotiations go on selecting the prime minister. What we do know from reporting is that a committee has been formed by the coordination framework to assess and perhaps interview potential candidates. And the three figures that have been mentioned are Humam Hammoudi, Ammar al-Hakim, and Abdus Saad al-Fureji. And those three individuals represent the broad spectrum of factions within the framework. So, for instance, Ammar al-Hakim represents the sort of centrist faction within the framework that includes Haider al-Ibadi. Humam Hammoudi represents the factions that are more closely aligned with Iran. And Foreji, who is part of the Nahj al-Watani, is very much aligned with Maliki. And so at this point in time, they are really just considering all of the different options available. But I do think that we will see the process accelerate very quickly once the results of the elections are certified by the Supreme Court.
It seems to me that the Shia parties, through the coordination framework, are prepared for the election process of the next prime minister. Whereas we see a little bit less order amongst the Kurdish and the Sunni blocs, including the Sunni-Kurdish bickering about the presidency. If you can talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so we mentioned last time that Mohamed Helbousi has on many occasions suggested that the presidency should become a share of the Sunni factions and that the Speaker of Parliament should be given to the Kurds instead. Now, the Kurds have very explicitly reacted in recent days by saying that they would oppose such a move. Now, Helbousi is not as strong as he was 4 years ago. His seat share has fallen, and that doesn't leave him in a strong position to really make those sorts of demands. However, I do think that with the divisions between the KDP and the PUK, that may work to Helbousi's advantage if he really does insist on pursuing this path to taking the presidency.
And do you think we'll have a repeat of the 2021 bickering between the KDP and PUK on who actually gets the presidency, especially given that the Kurdistan regional government has yet to be formed well over a year after they held elections?
Well, I think the Kurds are more divided than they were 4 years ago. And back then, there was a runoff between various candidates to decide on the president. They couldn't agree on that beforehand. And so I think it's unlikely that they will come to an agreement before the time comes to vote for the president in Parliament's chamber.
Given the level of negotiations taking place amongst the different factions, what can we expect in terms of smoothness or roughness of the government formation process this time around?
I think the signs indicate that there is a greater commitment by all factions to respecting the constitutional deadlines. And the judiciary has also emphasized this point. So I am more hopeful that we will not see as many delays as there were in the past. Obviously, the biggest obstacle will be deciding on who to nominate for the premiership. Having said that, I do think that the coordination framework as an organization has matured in many ways compared to 4 years ago in terms of the way that it makes decisions, in terms of developing mechanisms and criteria for deciding on how nominees are chosen. And that should speed up the process. And in Iraq, there are always lots of uncertainties that you really can't anticipate. But I do think that given the experience of the framework in previous years, they realize that it's not in their interest to make this process as drawn out as it was last time.
And why do you think the judiciary made a point of saying that constitutional timelines should be adhered to? Is it to avoid the mess that we had in 2021 and 2022?
There's now a collective interest, I believe, amongst the elite in maintaining the stability gains. And we still live in a very precarious regional environment. And so it's not really in anyone's interest to see this process drawn out and lead to conflict. So there are many incentives amongst the elite collectively to figure this out in an orderly fashion without too many delays.
Historically, we have formed governments pretty quickly when there are crises, whether it was 2014 with ISIS. Really, it was 2018 and 2021 when both domestically and regionally things were quiet that it took us a long time. 2021, we broke the 1 year mark. It took us forever to form a government. So I think you're right that we should see a relatively quick process this time around, and potentially within 4 to 6 months, we should have a new government.
One indicator of how long this process will take is the 15-day deadline for convening the first session of parliament once the results are certified. If we can have a speaker of parliament and the two deputies elected on that first session, then that will be quite an interesting precedent that will be set. Because as you know, in previous rounds of government formation, that process has been very drawn out, and they've always found this sort of legal loophole of keeping that session open so that they can buy more time to make those decisions about who to vote for. If a new speaker can be elected immediately on that day, then I think that sets in motion a process whereby the framework has to very quickly make a decision on who they want to nominate, because then you have the vote on the presidency, and then the president will, of course, nominate the chosen nominee from the largest bloc.
I'm sure we'll have further conversations as we reach these milestones. Thank you, Ali, for joining me today for this great conversation. That's it for this week's episode. Be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify to receive notifications about a new episode from Araki Voices. If you like this episode, be sure to share it with a friend or colleague. Until next time, take care.